I'm Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I used to often select at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 157th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we're looking at Classic, that's in parentheses, Classic Battlestar Galactica Volume 2, Number 1, a.k.a. Steampunk Battlestar Galactica 1880, Number 1. From Dynamite Entertainment, cover dated August 2014. But first, a little feedback. Two episodes ago, episode 155, we covered Sam Hill PI number 7, and Sir Martin of Grey let me know that there was more Sam Hill content out there than I was aware of. On that episode, I just mentioned the Kindle ebooks, but Martin discovered some more and pretty recent comic book appearances, and I downloaded them and read them, so here are brief comments on those. As Mart said, there's a recent Sam Hill meets Archie and the Gang one-off in the Archie 80th anniversary series. He picked it up for 99 cents. And Mart reported that it's a lot of fun, and I concur. This was a standard size comic with a standard Archie format of 4 5-page stories, although they do sort of have a light continuity, and that's actually a little more unusual with the classic Archie books. It turns out that Sam Hill is an old buddy of Pop Tate, which just adds to Pop's mysterious past, as far as I'm concerned. And Sam's drink of choice in the 1950s was milk, which does stand out in the hard-boiled world of PI stories. But in Riverdale, that makes him just kind of fit in, actually. Sam looks just like he does in the original 1952 comics, with just a bit of Archie style thrown in. But he's definitely recognizable as the same character. He solves a mystery at the chocolate shop and then heads to Lodge Manor as Mr. Lodge has hired him. That gig is to figure out how Archie keeps getting into the manor to visit Veronica and figure out how to stop him from getting in to visit Veronica. But his investigation leads Sam to believe that Archie is actually kind of a swell fella. He does one more job for Mr. Lodge, and then Veronica ropes him in for an Archie-related job on his way out of town. These were all very light stories, fitting right into the classic Archie world, much more than the 1950s, more hard-boiled world of the original Sam Hill. But like Mart said, it was a lot of fun. Sir Martin also found a Dark Circle digital-only graphic novel written by Tom DeFalco and Greg Scott. There were a few points that he had quibbles with. The girl Friday seems to be called Molly here, not Roxy. And Sam wears a regular tie. How dull. Bow ties are sexy. Yes, Martin, yes. Yes, they are. This series takes place in New York City, where Sam had been an NYPD detective. He left after his partner was killed, and some folk wonder if Sam had been involved. After all, Sam's secretary, Molly, is the daughter of the local mob boss, which puts poor Sam in the crosshairs of both the mob and the NYPD. This series is presented as 4 separate cases for Sam, but there is again a sense of forward motion as one adventure leads directly into the next. So you do have some key aspects of the Sam Hill mythos, including his drinking milk, the streaks of white hair, and a tense relationship with the local police. But, as Mark points out, Sam Hill PI with a regular tie? No, no, no. Fully agree. Now, I enjoyed the story. I thought it was good enough as a digital trade, but still, hashtag not my Sam Hill. Thanks so much for pointing all that out, Sir Martin. I had a blast revisiting Sam. And it's possible now that I have read almost all of the man's comic book appearances. Last time, we talked about the 100-page Walmart issue, Teen Titans Giant, number one. Billy D. from Into the Weird said it was a good show. My morning commute was spent with a friend. Thank you. Thank you, Billy. Kind words. Rob Myers from the Tim Drake podcast, Everyone Loves the Drake, said that they had covered a few of these. Might have to go back and finish them, he added. I collected the whole run. The Dan Jurgens original stories for these were really fun. Dr. Ange commented as well. I dipped my toes in and out of that Teen Titans run, hoping that it would get my attention. I think I still have the first year in my collection, but it never grabbed me long enough to keep me. Now, Super Sons, on the other hand, that was great. I've enjoyed a lot of what Bendis has done in the Superman books, but aging John, to have him join the Legion felt like a misstep. You can still have a teenage John joining the future team, just at some point in a future we never reach in comic book terms. You know, something totally timey-wimey. And then our buddy, the aforementioned Sir Martin of Grey, also had some things to say about that episode and that issue. Thanks for a nice listen, Professor. I've not got this issue, but I've read all the contents. The Johns McCone Teen Titans had its moments, but I hated that Johns erased all the character work Mark Waid and Carl Kessel had done with, respectively, Impulse and Superboy. In this, Impulse lost his fun personality and became just a second-rate Kid Flash, while Kal-El became Connor, complete with a new body type and the new power of super teen angst. As ever with Dan Jurgens, he writes an entertaining script for the new Teen Titans story, but I'd rather he'd given us his Titans, Grisk, Mirage, Hotspot, and Prism. And you know, I love the Super Sons. Talking about them makes me sad. DC had such a good thing going with Peter Tomasi's Superman family living in Hamilton. Bring that setup back in the next Universal Reset, I say. So say we all, Martin. So say we all. He adds that he liked Sideways a lot more than I did. I have no problem with DC having a Spidey knockoff. It's not like Marvel don't do it all the time with the likes of Nova and Ms. Marvel Kamala Khan. There's one issue of Sideways in which he's dealing with the aftermath of tragedy, and it's great. I do admit, Sir Martin, that my comments about the Sideways story were more snark than analysis, but for whatever reason, none of the seven issues of that I've read really reached out and grabbed me. Then Martin said he didn't know about the final page, those next issue boxes, sounds like a rotten waste of space. I'd rather have Who's Who reprints. The intro pages do make sense, though. Again, I love having an editor listen to the show. And then he ended saying that he didn't have a problem with a Superman comic having a Green Lantern backup, or Wonder Woman giant featuring Hoppy the Marvel Bunny, or whomever. You have your headline character, then you have your supporting strips. I don't see why they always have to be from the same comic family. Fair enough, Martin. Thank you for what was, as always, a well-thought-out reply. And Luke wrote in about that Walmart issue as well, saying he faithfully picked up the Walmart 100-page Giants right from the beginning. And I believe I'm only missing two of them, he says. One issue of the second volume of Swamp Thing Giant and the extremely elusive Detective Comics 80th Anniversary Giant. First off, let me say that while I have not read Teen Titans Giant, I have read many of the others, especially Superman, and some of the one-offs like Our Fighting Forces and Beyond the Unknown, and have enjoyed them. Yeah, that is a distinction that we have to make as comic book people, the distinction between owning something or not and having read it or not. So while Luke says he owns many, if not most, of the Walmart giants, he has not read them all. I think we can all identify with that aspect, with that situation, can't we? Luke says that even at a full price of $4.99, these represent a good value but I've not read a lot of the issues being reprinted, bringing the cost per page down pretty low. I was disappointed when this line of books ended, but we got a lot of content for the couple of years it was running, so I can't complain too loudly. Furthermore, he continues, if I was to complain, it would be drowned out by the litany of complaints I heard from the day this line was announced and continued right through their end. It seems that simply putting comic books in Walmart was suddenly offensive, mostly because there was exclusive content, meaning they couldn't just order the books at their LCS and had to, gasp, go inside a Walmart store. The negative drumbeat was incessant on these books, to the point that I stopped offering to pick them up for people. My offers were falling on deaf ears, it seemed. Some of the complaints really made me laugh. One of the news sites, probably Bleeding Cool because it sounds like them, stated that, without ever opening an issue, that the books were going to be chock full of ads. I did a quick check on the six giants beside my desk. They range from 4 pages of ads to 7. So let's call that 7% of each book are ads. Now, if we translate that to a standard size book, you're getting about 2.5 pages of ads. And I don't recall the last time I read a standard commercial comic book with 2.5 ad pages. So yeah, not exactly chock full of ads. Here in South Carolina, the books were easy to find and readily available. They were always racked in the same spot, the specialty aisle by the checkout, along with the collectible card games and blind box toys. Had their own point-of-sale display, a bright blue and white cardboard box emblazoned with a huge DC logo, and the fun Superman crying art when a title was sold out. And generally, I found that these books were available for 6 to 8 weeks after being put on sale. This goes for at least 5 different Walmarts in both the upstate of South Carolina and the CSRA regions. Additionally, my brother was able to find them in Lower New York, and I spotted them in Eastern Pennsylvania, no problem. All told, I'm enjoying reading through them, and glad that DC tried this program with Walmart. I know personally that I recommended these books to several parents and one aunt as good value comics for the kids, and my own children enjoy the heck out of them. My oldest daughter, for instance, loved The World's Finest Giant with Batwoman and Supergirl, as well as the Birds of Prey giant. Glad to see the line, get some love on the quarter bin, as well as, once again, properly applying the accounting rules of GAAP to the show. Keep up the good work. I'm eager to hear about more cheap comics soon. Sir Luke of the Upstate. Well, Luke, I'm certainly glad to give you the opportunity to get all of that off your chest. And on to the more general topic of my rule-breaking episodes. Tom Panarese said that he enjoyed the Breaking the Rules themes, but you know who is waiting in the wings to chastise you. Yeah, Tom, these rule-breaking episodes, these were totally DTS circumstances. Don't tell Stella. And to be honest, probably a good idea to keep everything from Shag as well. David Ace Gutierrez, formerly of the former Ultraverse Podcast Network, commented, Alan Slippery Slope Middleton. McZumo from the Man of Screen podcast allowed us how all of this rule-breaking was very scandalous. Sir Luke Giaconetti's response to all this breaking of norms, breaking of rules, paying 50 cents for a comic on the Quarterbin podcast? Gap strikes again. That's G-A-A-P. All capital letters, and by the way, that is an absolutely hilarious response, at least if you're familiar with the accounting rulemaking process. And no, GAAP does not stand for Goofy Allen Accounting Procedures. Social media love came from Manuel Carmona of Truthful Comics, Bill Baer from the Batpod, Zach, a.k.a. Nobody, Seth Tucker, Vic from Phoenix, Pat from the Longbox Crusade, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, the Mark's Mess Podcast, Dave's Comic Hero Blog, Randy Watts, Sean from the Nerdy Dads, Paul from the Collected Edition, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, Clinton from Fan Film Fridays, Randy Watts, Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower from the Hunters Podcast, Chris Lydon, Gene Hendricks from Anime Freaks, Chris from Professor Frenzy, It's a Show, Baby Skeletor, Old School Ross, and our listeners of the year, the kind and lovely Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. So, let's take a break here, play a promo, and when we get back, we'll be looking at Battlestar Galactica number 1, the steampunk version.
To confront the ultimate killers, I must construct the ultimate alias.
Hey, who is that lady? I think she could fly.
To combat the murderers who destroy my family, crush my own life on their way to consuming everything, I must become a greater, more fearsome destroyer.
Hey man, somebody killed this lady.
To track down the animals who prey on the innocent, I must stalk them first. I am no longer their quarry. I am the Huntress.
New Huntress Podcast, coming to you in 2019. Visit thehuntress89.blogspot.com for new episodes. Go to the Facebook page at Huntress Podcast. Go to Twitter, The Huntress Podcast. And you can always find episodes of The Huntress Podcast at rightonnetwork.com. And go to Apple iTunes, where this podcast is a joint venture with the Helena Bertinelli Podcast and the Cassandra Cain Batgirl Podcast. So go to Apple Podcasts, the Batgirl/Huntress Podcast.
And we're back. According to the information on the inside front cover, this is, parentheses, classic, Battlestar Galactica Volume 2, Number 1. Now the cover and the title logo call it Steampunk Battlestar Galactica 1880, number 1. And I know what you're all thinking. Where in the world will we file this in our comic boxes? I know, that's a key consideration for us here at Relatively Geeky. And this one is definitely a toughie. Fortunately, I'm going to pass this issue on to my brother-in-law after this episode, and so I'm not going to have to worry about that. That's going to be his problem. But whatever we want to call this officially, it was published by Dynamite Entertainment, was cover dated August 2014, and had a cover price of $3.99, which means I acquired this for more than 93% off that original sticker price. The cover by Adrian Sayaf shows a group of about a dozen characters, mostly human, a few human-machine hybrids, and in the back, one big old robot thing. And among them, you've got some pirate looks, goggles, eyepieces, capes, things that are all appropriately steampunk. So in that sense, it reflects the subject matter of the comic book just fine. And if you know what's going on in the title, you can guess that that big ugly robot in the back with the glowing red eyes is a Cylon. The story, for which I could find no title inside the issue, was written by Tony Lee and illustrated by, apologies for the pronunciation, Aneke. The credits include special thanks to Kim Nimi and point out that this is based on the Universal television series Battlestar Galactica created by Glenn A. Larson. The inside cover also includes this quote. There are those who believe that life began out there, far across the aether, with tribes of humans who may have been the forefathers of the Egyptians or the Toltecs or the Mayans. They may have been the architects of the Great Pyramids or the lost civilizations of Lemuria or Atlantis. Some believe that there may yet be brothers of man who even now fight to survive, far, far away, amongst the stars. Now, before I start the recap, I did want to talk about the art, or at least describe some of the design elements that are used here, just so you'll have an idea of how to visualize the action. And if it wasn't clear before, these are based on the characters from the 1970s original version of the TV show. That is the, parentheses, classic part of the title. So just for some artistic context, most of the fellas have capes of one kind or another. The ladies tend to wear bustiers and have long gloves, often a short jacket, boots of various lengths. There are goggles galore throughout the comic and a few optic implants and other cybernetic style modifications. In terms of weapons, some people carry laser guns and some carry swords. So like I said, that's just to give you some context to help you visualize. We start with a couple pages of history of the long fight between the Ovians and the Colonial Empire, which ended when Professor Baltar's creation of a clockwork race, the Cyclonics, turned the tide and end the conflict. Baltar's desire for power over the Colonial Empire is thwarted by Archduke Adama of the Aethership Galactica. As a result, Baltar absconds with his Cyclonic Knights and the Babbage computer that controls them. No one ever expected to see him or them again until Baltar returned to destroy Caprica. Crown Prince Apollo has come up with an attack plan. Apollo confuses Zachary for Starbuck, who is not available for the fight. On Apollo's orders, grapples are used to drag down the Cylons. On the Aether ship Galactica, Archduke Adama orders the ship about while belting out a rousing speech on how Caprica will not fall. In the air battle, a knight climbs upon Apollo's Viper and smashes the canopy. Another ship, the Atlantia, engages another towering Cylonic, which fires small little versions of Cylons at it. These smaller Cylon knights board the ship and take control of it and steer Atlantia straight into the planet. They've turned the huge Aether ship into a bomb. Adama orders an evacuation of Caprica, but to no avail. Atlantia explodes and kills all life on Caprica. The flight commander informs Adama that Apollo's vessel has been found floating in the atmosphere. Adama vows vengeance against Baltar and his creations as Lady Athena arrives, along with her young page, Boxy. Athena informs Adama that she has been visiting Lord Kane on Pegasus, and that Kane did not survive the attacks. Athena examines the Viper, voicing her belief that Apollo may have survived. Ty agrees that it could be possible if Baltar had desired it, and Athena believes that Apollo was abducted as a trophy for Baltar, as destroying Caprica would not be enough for him. This is in fact true. Professor Baltar has kidnapped Apollo. And he has plans for him in terms of his experiments of turning humans into Cylonics. Athena weeps, asking Ty for help. Ty notes that only one man could have a chance at saving Apollo. Flight Lieutenant Starbuck, a deserter whose name is no longer spoken. Athena learns Starbuck's location, the border world of Rising Star, and heads there to remind Starbuck about his life debt to Apollo. In the orbiting Cylonic prison, Baltar presents himself to Apollo as Imperious Lord Baltar, which I think is two steps past full professor. The ranking in academia goes assistant professor, associate professor, that's me by the way, full professor, professor emeritus, and then Imperious Leader. And I'll be honest, it doesn't look like I'm going to make it to that final rank. Imperious Leader Baltar debates what to do with Apollo, deciding to have him work his mines, noting that only Apollo's brain is required for the experiment. Apollo vows to kill Baltar. I'll end your life myself. I swear it. On Rising Star, Athena and Boxy make way to a bar where Starbuck is known to spend quality time. She asks if he thinks it's a trap. Yes, we're certain to die in a matter of centons. Athena asks the barkeep after Starbuck, but she is told that saying the name Starbuck isn't a way to make friends, and that Starbuck hasn't many on Rising Star. Athena flips one man over a table while a second pulls a gun on her. But before he can proceed further, the tip of Starbuck's sword comes close to the aggressor's face. The dude stands down, and he and his buddy head out of the bar post-haste. After exchanging barbs regarding Starbuck's current state of drunkenness, he directs Athena to his office, an out-of-the-way table at the back of the bar. A Cylonic Knight pushes Apollo into a cell where he encounters Boomer, an old acquaintance from the Ovion War who had been banished. Boomer has been converted by Baltar into a half-human, half-clockwork machine. Apollo recruits Boomer and Jolly to his cause, assuring them that he does not view them as enemies, while promising that they will be returned to the nobility of the Colonial Empire. All they have to do is help him escape as soon as their vessel lands. Back in the bar, Starbuck tells Athena that he told Adama that Baltar couldn't be trusted. After that, Starbuck was forced out of the leadership body, the Quorum of Twelve. Their conversation is interrupted by Starbuck's second-in-command, a Daggett named Muffet. Athena is shocked at the presence of Muffet, noting that Daggets are unstable. Muffet informs Starbuck that someone is looking for payment, which he brushes off. You get the idea that Starbuck owes plenty of people plenty of payments. But as Starbuck is about to leave, he imparts his sorrow of what had transpired on Caprica, and is uncertain about what he can do to help win this new war. Athena tells Starbuck that she doesn't care about the war, noting her only concern is Apollo. This changes Starbuck's tune, noting that she should have simply said that in the first place. So they head to his ship, Star Chaser. He tells her that there's no faster ship in the Aether, after the addition of the special modifications that he made. But before they can lift off, Queen Sheba and her band of pirates arrive. Sheba claims Starbuck stole some credits from her. But before they can settle that little circumstance, Queen Sheba's sister, Queen Cassiopeia, arrives, demanding satisfaction first, seeing as Starbuck wronged her first. Starbuck briefly explains the situation, while Sheba senses that Cassiopeia slept with Starbuck. Oh, that is ripe for mockery. And on the last page, we get everybody's sword drawn, and Queen Sheba makes a proposal to settle this whole confusing situation. A three-way fight to the death. Winner takes all. My crew, against my sister's crew, against you and that lady. The end. I have three areas of discussion that I'm going to focus on for this analysis portion. And first is my experience with Battlestar Galactica. In terms of the classic edition of the show, I actually don't have a lot of experience. I do have a memory of the two-hour pilot TV movie thing, that coming out. But I don't know if I watched it or not. I want to say I probably watched some of that pilot, that movie, and maybe a bit of an episode or two, but that's it. It was certainly not something that I watched regularly or even thought particularly highly of. When this show was fresh on TV, I had just gotten back from spending 3 years overseas. and had been back a few months is all, and getting reestablished in school and all that, so watching TV was not, I guess, a priority for me. I like sci-fi well enough, and maybe, I don't know, but maybe I was a bit of a Star Wars snob, and could tell that BSG had a lower budget, and was vaguely a ripoff, and maybe that kept me away. But rest assured, there is someone in my household that watched the original Battlestar Galactica back in the day. Because Mrs. Quarterbin doesn't come across all the time as the biggest nerd in the world, but she has a very nerdly heritage. I've mentioned my brother-in-law Phil before here on the network, and he and Valerie are twins, and they spent a lot of time in the 1970s, and some of the 1960s, but don't tell her I said that, okay? Sitting next to each other on the family couch, watching cartoons and sci-fi TV. So she has deeply nostalgic feelings for a ton of shows from this era. She and Phil watched it all. The Hulk, Super Friends, Star Trek, the original series and the animated, Batman, Wonder Woman, Greatest American Hero, Shazam and Isis, Buck Rogers. And this, I think, came in very handy when we met, because when I took some time freshman year to walk to the comic store, or even the fact that I had 100 or so comics in my dorm room, that didn't weird her out. And let me give a little dating advice here, and that's when you're a fella meeting a lady-type female person, the very first thing you want to do is not weird her out. So Mrs. Quarterbin is very geek-friendly, certainly geek-indulgent, because deep down, she's a bit of a geek herself. And like I said, when it comes to the original version of BSG, she's way more a fan of it than I am. Which is 180 degrees off our feelings about the reimagined version from the aughts. She hated it, the darkness of it, the out-and-out bleakness. I really enjoyed it. The show was really where it was for me. The first two-thirds or so of the series especially, when we were able to believe the five-word promise that we were given every episode, and they have a plan. That was a metatextual promise that, as it applied both to the Cylons having a plan within the world of the show, but it was also a promise from Ron Moore and the writing team that they had a plan as well. And it turned out, as we moved into the last season, certainly the last half of the last season, that neither the Cylons nor the writers, in fact, you know, had a plan. Or had a sensible plan, at least. But let's jump back to the original classic take on Battlestar. And look at how well this comic did, reflecting the basics of what that series represented. And I think it did it pretty well. If you strip down the basics of 1970s Battlestar, you'd end up with things like the Cylon War, betrayal by Baltar, the destruction of Caprica, the survival of Galactica, Adama in charge, Starbuck as a wild card, Apollo, Athena, Ty, even Boxy and Daggett. And that's what you get here, right? I'm not knowing at this point where the story goes. It seems, at least through issue one, that you've got most of the key elements of classic Battlestar Galactica. So I think it passes inspection on those grounds. Of course, like I said, it probably helps that I'm not overly tied to that take on the TV show. Keep that in mind. But I think the writer did what he needed to do on those grounds. which leads me to my second topic, the writer, Tony Lee. Back about 8 or 9 years ago, the Doctor Who license was acquired by Titan Books, and as the show hit its peak popularity around that time, David Tennant and Matt Smith that era, Titan flooded the market with lots of product featuring lots of different Doctors. And I think one of the effects of that is that the prior licensee, IDW, the books that they put out from, say, 2006-ish to about 2010, those books might as well be lost to the mists of time for all the attention they get nowadays. And that's where I know Tony Lee from. He wrote a ton, possibly all, or very close to all, of the IDW Doctor Who books. And they were very good, very enjoyable. And so I was excited to flip this open and see his involvement, because I've had good luck with his work in the past. I saw online an interview with Tony Lee talking about how he got this assignment, how he got this book. And the way he found out was he was on break from a meeting with a Hollywood producer who he was giving a pitch to. So here's an abridged version of him telling the story. So I check my emails, and there's one from Joe Riband and Nick Barucci. These are top executives at Dynamite. And there's one from Joe and Nick saying that they've had this idea for a steampunk Battlestar Galactica series. They're not sure how it'd work, but to dive in any thoughts on it, that sort of thing. The producer comes back in at this point, and from the look on my face, he knows I've hit some kind of motherload. So I tell him. And it turns out he's a massive Battlestar Galactica fan, and we spend the next 10 minutes bonding as I explain how I'd do a steampunk Battlestar Galactica series before moving back to the movie that I was actually there to pitch. But those 10 minutes were invaluable, as it meant that by the time I replied to Joe and Nick, I already had a pretty fully fleshed out idea of what I wanted to do and how I wanted to play it. And bar a couple of characters here and there, this is pretty much how I envisioned it back at that meeting. So that was an interesting story. It's always interesting to hear how things like this happen, how assignments come, how ideas are developed. And in terms of the work that Lee did, the technical aspects of the writing, plot, scripting, the pacing, the necessary humor of that final scene, I think all that was done pretty well. It was an enjoyable, well-written comic. And then lastly, I want to talk about the steampunk element, where they integrated into the story. And this is where I have the biggest issues with the issue. First thing first, the cover copy, the logo, steampunk, Battlestar Galactica 1880. What does 1880 have to do with this? It's a nonsensical inclusion here. I have a feeling I know why they did it. I can come up with two reasons, actually. Well, I guess they are sort of related reasons. The steampunk genre generally takes place in the Victorian era, or at least that's the jumping off point, of which 1880 is basically right in the middle. So it does emphasize the related time period here in our Earth history to those potential readers who would be drawn to the cover by the Battlestar Galactica name but might not know what steampunk is. So that 1880, I think, is there to give them an idea, give them a clue. It's also, I believe, a deep inside joke referencing the execrable Galactica 1980 property. 1980, 1880, okay, I get it. Doesn't mean it makes any sense, though, or that I have to like it. And that's kind of how the rest of the steampunk elements were treated, as far as I'm concerned, which is to say, without a ton of thought, just a surface gloss, just some design elements. It's kind of like cosplay, and I mean specifically like amateur, just-for-fun cosplay. Taking just a few of the identifiable elements here, that's goggles and bustiers and swords, and just laying them atop your characters. It doesn't go beyond the design elements. It doesn't push any deeper. And even there, even on design, it doesn't go far enough. There aren't many gears, no top hats. Like I said in the summary, this is as much sci-fi pirate as it is steampunk. For one thing, I didn't see much, if any, actual steam power. That's kind of a key aspect to steampunk. It would be kind of like having a cyberpunk story with no cyber in it. And there is a lot of potential for true steampunk elements in this story. We do have airships, or aether ships, that's A-E-T-H-E-R, if you're not familiar with steampunk lingo. But they don't have any steam or otherwise old-timey aspects. These ships much more resemble raiders and vipers than they do, say, zeppelins. And most obviously you have Cylons or Cylonics. I think I may have said Cyclonics before in the summary once or twice, but it's Cylonics. So you have this great opportunity to make fighting, gear, and steam-based metal monsters. But they just don't... They're just alternate universe Cylons. And maybe that's my main criticism here. They just don't go as far as they could have. They wanted to call this steampunk, get the branding of steampunk, but not dig deep into what steampunk really is. The other side of steampunk, the other side of the Victorian era, is the Dickensian aspect. And again, there's a missed opportunity here. A common theme in steampunk is oppression of workers. The notion that the fires that produce the all-important steam, that is just ugly work, hard work. Sometimes it's literally slave labor, sometimes just a step or two removed. And between the Cylons and even High Associate Dean Baltar, or whatever he's calling himself, for either of those, right, oppression is not out of the question. Baltar has humans in the brig on his ship. In a more fully committed steampunk work, those prisoners would be in the fire pits, the boiler room, whatever. But that's just not here. And it easily could have been. Let me say that in general, I'm not a fan of reviewing the work you wanted to read, reviewing the work you were expecting, instead of the work that you actually have. But when a work identifies itself with a genre, which I think steampunk is, certainly a subgenre, there are expectations that come with that identification. And I think it's fair to examine those, to see how well a work does with those expectations, what they do with those expectations. Okay, enough on that topic. But let me summarize my thoughts with this. I've read Lady Mechanica. I'm a fan of Lady Mechanica. I have signed copies of Lady Mechanica. Steampunk Battlestar Galactica 1880, you are no Lady Mechanica. And so the question here at the end is, how much am I going to let that lack of real steampunk aspects in this story? How much is that going to be reflected in my verdict? The verdict on Steampunk Battlestar Galactica 1880, number one. If you squint at the steampunk stuff and just think of this as an Elseworlds, lightly steampunk-inspired Galactica, it's pretty good. I do wish it had done things a little differently. But what it chooses to do, and how it chooses to do that, it does pretty well. And that is the very definition of a quarter bin deal. That wraps up my coverage of Steampunk Battlestar Galactica 1880, number one, bringing episode 157 to a close. But it's not the end of my reading or talking about this miniseries, because I just recently downloaded the whole mini, all four issues, from the Hoopla digital app. But I've not read those further issues as of this recording. I wanted to keep my thoughts uncluttered by what happens in the future issues to solely and completely focus on this one. But I am sure I will talk about them at least a little bit on the September version of the Comics Reading Journal. And that really does add legitimacy to my claim that this is a quarter bin deal, because our good buddy and regular guest Paul Spatero, as he likes to say, the main goal of an issue one, the measure of its success, is whether it brings you back for issue two. And this one definitely, literally, did that. I want to give a shout out to BattlestarWiki.org, which has a ton of info about all versions of this property, including some info that I used in putting together the synopsis and aiding my analysis. If you, lovely listener, are interested in any aspect, I mean any aspect, of the Battlestar Galactica world, no matter how small that aspect may be, check out BattlestarWiki.org. Next time, we're staying in the world of smaller publishers and staying in the world of licensed comics. That was an accident. It just worked out that way. Kind of like the Cylons in the reimagined BSG, I did not have a plan, and I'm willing to admit that. We will be spending the next two quarter bin episodes, as a matter of fact, knocking out a five-issue miniseries. So specifically next time, it'll be Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan the Warrior 1 and 2 from Malibu Comics, cover dated March and May 1992. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode, any version of Battlestar Galactica, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.